Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week, Victoria Mathewson. Victoria, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, more than glad to have you. Now, Victoria has a new book out, and we're going to get to that, Needlepointed Plants and Pollinators. And if you are a follower of Mary Corbett, last week she reviewed the book. So go to Mary's needleandthread.com and read the review of the book. And we're going to talk about the book, but more interested in how it came to be and what was behind it and so on and so forth. And then you can read Mary's review to learn what's in the book. But terrific book, Needle Painted Plants and Pollinators. And Victoria, yeah, that's really good. But all that's just wonderful. But at the moment, I don't care because I want to know about your sewing shed. Because you win.
It's really not that glamorous, but as most people, I started sewing in the house, and then you start collecting more and more sewing bits and bobs, and I started taking over the house, and I could see my husband wasn't best pleased with it, so I thought, well, I'll build myself a shed in the garden, and bought a kit of a 7-foot by 5-foot summer house, and my neighbor and I spent a couple of days putting it up, and that's now my office. It's lovely and cozy out here. I've sort of insulated it and got heaters, but it is a bit cluttered at the moment with threads and fabric and everything everywhere.
Yeah, 7 by 5 foot will make you keep tidy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm always looking for new storage solutions, but the actual embroidery itself doesn't take up much room, so it's perfect.
It's nice because it's outside, so you're not. I like to be outside, but I don't have a spot for that. And that, like, I saw that, and I'm like, how perfect! She gets to be out in nature, gets to see it, and stitch. Do some of my favorite things: being in the garden and being stitching. So I was like, oh, I've got to get me one of those.
Yeah, well, I mean, our back garden isn't very big at all, so I couldn't really have anything bigger than a 7 by 5. Shed, but it is lovely being out here, especially in the summer. I mean, I'm in Wales, so the weather isn't great a lot of the time. It's raining at the moment while I'm out here, but actually it's quite cozy out here when it's raining heavily. And then in summer you get distracted because you get all the birds in the garden, and I get quite a few nests in the garden, so you see all the visitors coming and going, and it is lovely. And you can, in the middle of summer, open the doors, hear the bees. And it's a bit distracting, though. Yeah, you're trying to stitch and you get distracted by, what's going on in the garden and the ladybirds and the dragonflies.
Well, you have windows. I mean, it's just a great little box to just go get away. And there's windows so you have it insulated, so you have a heater, and where you're at, you probably don't need air conditioning very much.
No, that's called opening the doors here.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it doesn't, it's, as I say, it was a kit for a summer house rather than a shed, really, but so that's why it's got the double doors and the windows, and you get some nice light coming in here, and it's just really comfortable. I like to come out here and close the door and shut everything out, shut everything that's going on in the house out. And the kids leave me to it.
Yeah, that sets a very clear border. Leave me alone. Yeah.
Interesting time. My quiet time. I'm closing the doors. Don't burn the house down.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's I'd never seen one like that. I mean, people have stitching rooms and that kind of thing, but to get a ready-made kit, plunk it down in the backyard and set yourself up, that's ideal stuff right there. Yep.
Yeah. The neighbors see me sort of heading out each day with my cup of tea and see me sitting in here working and probably think I'm a crazy woman, but I don't mind. Yeah.
Let them think it. You win. You win. That's a good one. So, okay, so how do you get started with this embroidery that now has resulted in a book? You learn as a kid?
Yeah, well, if we go right back, when I was at primary school, so I was about 10, 11, we all learnt cross-stitch at that point. I'm not sure they do it now, but we learnt cross-stitch back then. And everyone sort of came back with designs for square houses and square dogs and very basic designs, which was fine. But I was like, no, I want to create a floral wreath with a Celtic border. And I headed off to the library, my local library, and found some books on cross-stitching and came back with this rather elaborate cross-stitch, which the teachers weren't expecting. And then I sort of took it from there. So I did odd bits as a teenager, mostly cross-stitch then. And then headed off to drama school. And while I was at drama school, you'd end up sitting in rehearsals for a long time if you only had a few lines. And I was stitching my graduation dress and thought, I'm going to have a go at embroidering all over this, and didn't really know what I was doing, but picked up a hoop and just, like a lot of people, I've inherited a lot of old embroidery threads from my grandma and my mum, sort of a big tangled mess, but I separated them all out and just sat there stitching pictures that I'd found that I liked and started to really enjoy it. I didn't really know any techniques at that point, and I made it up as I went along, but in actual fact it wasn't much different to what I'm doing now. It sort of carried on as a hobby until after my second daughter was born, which, well, she's 11 now, and I didn't go back to work after that, and tried to think, well, you know, what do I enjoy? What could I start spending some time trying to do when I do have free time? Learning more of, and carried on with the same technique with cotton thread. And I got in touch with, there's an embroidery artist over here called Helen M. Stevens. And I showed her some of my work and she said, oh, have you ever tried working in silk? So invested in a few floss silk threads, and I was just absolutely sold on it. and thought, oh, you know, this is for me, this is what I want to specialize in. And took it from there, really. So that's where the silk side came into it.
So you, all right, you saw an opportunity here to develop a creative art side with thread. Why not paint? Why not colored pencil or something like that? What was it? You know what I mean?
You could say I'm a sucker for punishment, but no, I mean, I love drawing. I've always loved drawing, and I've always loved painting. And when I was a teenager, I didn't have a canvas big enough, so I said to my dad, you know, can I paint on the walls? And he sort of said, okay, yeah, sure. And I covered my wall in large paintings. But I took the idea of painting and drawing and just thought, well, if I can draw it, I can stitch it. And there's something that I find even more relaxing about stitching that you don't necessarily get with, well, you do get with drawing and painting, but even more so with stitching. And I guess I also love the idea that you could then go on to stitch on clothing and you could wear your art. And I started making jewellery at one point, which I thought was a way of, you know, creating this art so that you could wear. And I just love the tactile nature of the silk threads. Once you've created that piece, you almost want to stroke it because it looks so, it's just so beautiful and tactile.
Yeah, there's something about threads versus paints that, you know, it does. It makes you want to touch them versus a painting just look at. You know, you're just going to look at. No one wants to go and touch a painting, right? But
yeah.
Anything, you know, made with a thread, you know, quilts, that's why they have all the signs at the art quilt shows. Please do not touch the quilt because everyone wants to touch them.
Yeah, yeah. And after a while, it builds up, doesn't it?
Right, right. So you can't. So, but understand the need, the tactileness of using stitching and thread.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I was going to ask if you came from an artistic background with parents who are supportive, but you answered all that when you said your dad said it was okay to paint on the walls. That's wow.
Well, yeah. I mean, my mum did some sewing, and my grandma did some tapestry. She was mostly a watercolor artist, painting flowers, and my other grandmother was a ballet dancer, and so an artistic family, but in lots of different areas. My father loves building model trains and built a railway around his garden and has his own large workshop with model railway layouts. So we all express our artistic side in different ways in my family.
But without a doubt, a creative culture that you grew up in. So plenty of opportunity. Yeah.
Definitely. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good thing. So when do you say to yourself, wait a minute, I can make some money off of this? Or is that just evolved into it? Or did you make a conscious decision at some point and say, hey, I can make a business out of this?
Well, it's, yeah, I mean, I think we probably all find that there's not really a huge amount of money in textiles. But it's, I did go into it after, as I say, I didn't go back to work. I did go into it with the idea of, well, you know, can I make money from this? Because it would be nice to be my own boss and not have to go back to work so that I can be there at home for the children when they come back from school and look after them at the same time. And as I say, I started with the jewellery, but moved away from that because it's very difficult. I suppose this goes back to the whole art versus craft argument with embroidery. It's very difficult to get people to appreciate how much time and effort goes into creating a piece of embroidered jewellery. So the money just wasn't going to be there. And the money side is something that I'm still working on. Let's say that, you know, looking into the future, kits are always something to look into, or lessons. And I'm hoping that the book will open up those sort of doors for me. In an ideal world, if I could go back and train again, I would train to do costume work for film and television. I'd love to get into that. But yeah, the idea was that I could somehow try and make money from this so that I could then be at home with the children.
Nothing wrong with that. Not at all.
Mm.
So, all right, your book is really a mix of support for the, you know, the environment and insects and all those things and needlework. Where have you always also had a love for the outdoors and nature?
I've always had a love of nature and the outdoors and walking. I love to go walking. We're very lucky where I live to have some beautiful scenery and beautiful walks. Well, when I first started embroidering after my daughter was born, my main subject matter was wildflowers. And that was A, because I love them, but B, partly convenience, because I'm out on walks and you're seeing all of these wildflowers, and it's so easy to then get reference photos and work from those and create your own artwork. The insects came a little bit later, actually, when I started off. I managed to get a photograph of a bee on lavender and I embroidered that, and I liked that. But then I took a photo of a garden spider, And I looked at the markings on it and I just thought they were so beautiful, and they really fitted with thread and your thread direction and the patterns that you could create with it. And so I stitched the spider, and it got a great reaction on the internet, and I started to get entomologists following me as well, and got into some great conversations with them. And it was a little bit addictive that, you know, once I'd done the spider, then everywhere I looked, I'd see these fascinating insects, and not just the, you know, the beautiful butterflies, but, you know, if you look at certain flies, they can be absolutely beautiful when you look up close. And the idea for pollinators came from a gentleman on Instagram called Peter Coffey, an American entomologist. And he put a photograph of a fly on a flower and just said, bees aren't the only pollinators. And I just thought, yeah, that would, I know that, but I don't know much about it. So I started looking into it and found out that entomologists get frustrated that when people say pollinators, they're usually referring to honeybees, and no one ever really bigs up the other pollinators, the moths, the beetles, the butterflies. And I thought, well, this is really interesting subject matter that can translate into embroidery that people need to be aware of, that everyone says save the bees, but, you know, save the butterflies, save the moths, and you know, and so that was sort of where the insects came into it and the idea for the book.
It's a great and unique idea. Now, when you talk about noticing insects, you know, that's something that happens with photography in general, is you walk up to a scene and you see like a bed of flowers. And the longer you stand there and photograph it, then you start to see all those little pieces. And so I know that feeling of, oh, that insect there, I'd never seen that before. And you start to pick out all the little pieces, and then it really comes alive. Yeah,
it is. If you just go into your back, it's so accessible to everyone. If you just go into your back garden, or even if you just got a potted plant on your windowsill, you know, you can just go and just find this whole world. And as you say, yeah, once you notice one, then you notice more, and it's amazing. It's great.
I think I have two boys, and we would go and look. I homeschooled them, and we'd go look at bugs in the yard. And it, to me, I was always fascinated by, you know, sometimes we think, oh, bugs, you know, squeamish, but they have so many beautiful colors on them. Some of them are shiny. And I always thought, oh, they would translate into stitching, but I never did the step you did, where you put needle and thread together and you stitch them. I want to almost say personalities, but you know, when I was looking through your book, I was thinking, oh, look at all these, you know, and I've seen, you know, similar in the United States to what you showed in your book. And I was like, oh yeah, we've got those pollinators here and we just ignore them. I love the stories you wove into the book. It seemed like when you, the pollinators with the flowers you paired them with. So did you do your own research on that, or did you have an entomologist help you?
Well, it was a bit of both, really. I did my own research. We have a charity over here called Bug Life, and it's a fountain of information on their website. There was a document that split the different pollinator groups. So you had bees, flies, beetles, moths, butterflies and wasps. And so I thought, well, okay, if I take each of those groups and find one or two examples for each group, and find a plant that either that individual pollinator is drawn to, or maybe in the same environment as that pollinator, and combine the two, and then put the information together. But I did go back to bug life. And there's a gentleman there called Paul Hetherington, who very kindly said he would fact check everything for me. When I'd created the embroidery and written the introduction for it, I'd send it off to him, and he would pick up on anything that I'd got wrong, or, you know, give me some additional information. He was telling me that, you know, without certain midges, we wouldn't have chocolate, because they're only pollinated by this very tiny midge fly. So he came back with all this great information for me. So it's been a bit of a collaboration, really.
It just made me think, because I know, like, pears, people don't think much about them, but I think if you don't have a certain kind of pollinator, you're not going to have pears. I know Asia, they lost theirs, and they have to hand pollinating their pears.
Oh, right. Wow. Yeah. No, that's one of the, I was reading an article the other day, and it was saying that there is actually a danger to just focusing on bees, or just focusing on honeybees anyway, obviously not wild bees, but just focusing on honeybees. It can actually be detrimental to other pollinators, because there are certain plants that need specific pollinators. And if everything is just aimed at honeybees, then, you know, the balance is wrong.
Yeah, well, that's the thing that I like about your book, is in the world of needlework books, this one stands out because you have that mixture of, all right, here's the needlework, here's how we show the beauty of these pollinators and the plants, but then woven into that is a very clear statement that we have to be careful with our pest. Well, we need to be careful with our pesticides in general, but just in the way we go about agriculture and gardening in general, because we need to protect these insects that most people either run away from or want to smash, you know, when they see them. And we really have to, because what was the statement you made early in the book about how without insects, just, you know, everything just collapses. And, we don't want them in our house, but we have to appreciate the value they have in the ecosystem and protect them and allow them to thrive. And
yeah, exactly. I think it was David Attenborough that was saying that if humans disappeared off the earth would cope quite nicely, thank you, but if insects if insects disappeared, the ecosystem would collapse. And as you say, a lot of these insects people are either scared of or don't even notice. And I found that when I'm stitching an insect, because the process of needle painting takes so long and you work so closely with that subject matter, you start to really get a respect for it, and as you have to study each part of the insect so closely. And I'm scared of spiders, and I'm still not great with spiders, but stitching the original garden spider actually helped me with a lot of my fears, because I started to look at how beautiful it was when you get up close. And whilst I'm still not a great fan, but I've got a real respect for them now. And as I say in the book, I've got a common wasp in there, and most people absolutely hate wasps. And as I say, I can't persuade you to love them, but at least respect that they have a role and try and put up with them if you can.
So does all of this make you a bit of an activist in your area for the nature around you, or is it pretty well protected just in general? Because you talk about this marsh that you're able to walk through and this kind of nature preserve that sounds beautiful.
Yeah, it is. I'm very lucky. We have the Wildlife Trust over here, and the area we're in is Gwent. And Gwent Wildlife Trust has its flagship site, which is Mega Marsh, and that's actually in our village. And it's not huge, but it's a beautiful site, and I walk there nearly every morning. And I'm looking, hoping to do some workshops there maybe in the future. But I mean, the UK is one of the most nature depleted countries in the world, and so it's not great over here. But you know, we're making small steps, and I wish I could do more. But I thought to myself, well, my skill is embroidery. How can I use that to help in my own small way? And I guess the book is my way of saying, well, this is what I can offer to try and help a little bit.
Yeah.
And if it changes one person's mind, then it's helped. So.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You never know where something like this is going to go. You get one person and the geometric progression from there could be quite impactful. Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, all right. So how does the book come about? Is it an idea that you present to the publisher, or do you have this collection of embroidered pieces and you say this could make a book? How do we get going on the path? Because doing a book is not something you just do on a whim.
Well, another publisher had got in touch with me beforehand and asked if I fancied having a go at making a book. And I was brimming with ideas for pollinators. So I took that to them, but they weren't convinced by the idea of a whole book on pollinators. So it didn't really go anywhere. But then I had other friends who published books with Search Press and said that they were a great publishers to work with. So I put together a pitch. I didn't really have any individual designs at that point, but I'd had the idea of, trying to do an embroidery around wasps and maybe including the ladybird. And so I put a pitch together and took it to them, and they were great. They jumped at the chance, and they were really wonderful, because I said, it's a little bit of a crossover book, and I'm not sure whether people will get it, as in it is an embroidery book, but it's also an educational book, and it's a conservation book, and it crosses over genres. And they were great. They gave me pretty much free rein to take the book where I wanted and left me to it. And I just submitted it to them, and they put it together to look pretty amazing. That's where it went from. So the first thing was the pitch and the idea. I didn't actually have the projects at that point.
Okay. Now, that's something that other people that we've talked to who have used Search Press to publish their books, that seems to be a common theme, that we settle on a book and what we're going to do, and then they let the artist, they get out of the way and let the artist do their thing. And I think that approach is excellent, but it also gives a better product, I think.
I think so. I think the previous publishers that had approached me wanted me to add different animals, so hedgehogs or blackbirds, and that's not really what I do. And I think I really would have struggled, and the book wouldn't have sat very well together, because it just wasn't my style. So I definitely think that a certain amount of free rein to express what you want to say about the work that you do is the best way to go.
All right, so you have a book, you got somebody who wants to publish it, but you don't have any designs. Oops.
Yeah. I sat down and started. Well, I started going through all my photos first, because I've got packets and packets of photos of every time I go out for a walk, especially with my family, and they have to wait for me because I'm photographing an interesting bug. I've got packets and packets of photos. So I started off going through those and separating out the ones that I thought, well, you know, that could work. That's a pollinator. And then it was thinking, well, which ones can be simplified down so that other people might have a chance at having a go at embroidering that? I don't want to make it too complicated. And then looking at the colors and the plants that go with it.
Let me interrupt you there, because I think that's an interesting point from a designer perspective, is those decisions you have to make when you're putting a design together that make the design accessible to a wider audience. I mean, you have to make some very definite decisions about how, you know, you're doing a one-off and you might sit there for hours on just this one little area, but you have to have then an appreciation for the greater needlework audience, and they may not be so interested in that little detail.
Yeah, well, exactly. And if I'm doing a piece of art that is just for me, or to, you know, to go on and try and sell, I could use 30, 40, 50 different colors. And I've got pots of different colors of silk here. But if I'm trying to allow other people to have a go, I need to try and reduce that amount. So taking the colors down to, I don't know, maybe 15 different colors instead, and simplifying lines to make it easier to follow. And yeah, it is difficult each step of the way. How do I explain that step that I've just done there? So when I'm sewing a piece for myself, I'll dot here and there and unpick bits that don't work and make it up as I go along. But someone who's trying to follow a pattern, they need very clear, you know, steps and stitch direction all guided out for them. And also, it's got to be enjoyable for the person at the end of the day. It's if you've got if I'm doing a piece of art for myself, I could have anything up to sort of 10 needles threaded at once, all parked around the edge of the fabric ready to go. But that's complicated, and that takes a long time to get used to, you know. And it takes quite a lot of concentration. If I'm doing something for enjoyment, I want to be able to sit there of an evening with the TV on in the background and you know, just follow simple instructions and simple blocks of color, but also have a beautiful piece at the end. Yeah, I'd also say, you know, I have said in the book, don't feel that you have to do a whole project. If you just want to have a go at one small part of the project, just take one of the flowers, one of the blossoms, or just do the bug, then do that and do it in whatever color you want. Yeah.
Right. Well, and I bring that up not to suggest that you've dumbed down your designs so that the common man or woman can stitch them, but you have to make those kinds of decisions, and there's nothing that prevents the person who is doing one of your designs from then taking it to another level if they want to. But you at least are giving them an approachable foundation and something that will give a beautiful product when they're all done without undue stress, I guess it is.
Yeah.
It's an interesting juncture for designers that you have to make those decisions if you're going to reach an audience.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. I want to give people the experience of trying this stuff, but then taking it away and creating their own style. I mean, I've never actually had official training. I learned a lot of the actual technique from Trish Burr's books on long and short stitch.
That's a good source. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, her books are amazing. And I didn't really follow her pattern so much, but her guidance is wonderful. So I would learn the guidance in her book, but then I take that away and start playing with it and coming up with my own style and technique. And that's what I want other people to do. I want them to hopefully find some inspiration in the book and then go away and see what they come up with.
Yeah.
Say that's an interesting part. You know, you have a whole section on that, on inspiration, working from a photograph, so that, you know, because sometimes we take these, we have these, all these beautiful photographs we've taken, and it's like, okay, I'd like to stitch this up, but it's got way too much stuff in it. And you kind of go through that. How do you go and, you know, kind of clean up a photograph and, you know, take it and simplify it to make it into a design? You kind of do a little bit of explaining of that in your book, which I found fascinating to read.
As I said in the book, what I do is I'll look at a photo and immediately try and picture myself stitching it. If you can picture how you're going to lay the stitches and what direction they're going to go in, then you've got a pretty good chance of being able to translate that into an embroidery. But if you look at it and think, I haven't got a clue how to start on that one, then maybe pick a different picture.
So you're going through your collection of photos, and now you have to make some decisions. Is that it sounds like you had an awful lot of photos to choose from.
Yeah, hundreds of different photos. I mean, and some of them, you know, it's like you can immediately throw out the snails. They're not pollinators, but I'd make initial sketches, and I could tell pretty soon if something wasn't going to work. And I came up with the 9 designs that I was happiest with. And ideally, I would have loved to have taken that to 10 because it's a nice round number. But you know, if you look at the different groupings of the pollinators and the time it takes to actually stitch them, then I thought, no, these 9, they are, you know, I think they sit well together as a group. And I took the designs, I sent them off to Search Press and said, you know, are you happy with these? And they came back and went, yep, go for it. I came up with the designs, as I say, amalgamating different photographs. So I'd have a photograph you got the 6-spot burnet moth, and then a separate photograph of the knapweed that sits with it. And as I talk about in the book, I take a lot of the inspiration from the photographs, but then there's nothing wrong with using other sources to help guide you to get it correct. If photographing bugs is notoriously difficult, they don't sit still for you. So you quite often miss important parts. So you can get extra information and inspiration from the internet, from photographs of the same bug or from books. But as I say in the book, don't ever just copy someone else's photograph or drawing, because that's their intellectual property. So it's a case of using your own sources, your own photographs, and then adapting them and pulling together all your information.
Now, when you take the photograph, then your next step is to do a line drawing to get the form and shape of the embroidery thing. I assume there's a modification going on there from the photograph and adjustments. I got to believe that once you start to do a design that you're going to embroider, that a photograph doesn't translate 100%.
No, it doesn't translate 100%. It can be just too complicated. I usually start off with, as you say, a pencil drawing. The pencil drawings that I try and do, they can almost be a piece of art in themselves. It's got the full shading and the full detail on, but then I'll go over the lines of the actual drawing, almost creating the template. So just looking at the main aspects of that drawing, and simplifying them down. Some areas that are just too complicated, you'll just have to sort of fudge over with your stitch direction, flowing it in. But the complication comes when you still want to be accurate. I still want these bugs to be as accurate as possible, so that they are educational as well. But yeah, the template comes then from the pencil drawing, and then I translate that on the iPad with the help of my daughter, because she's better at it than me. then that basic outline from the pencil drawing becomes my template.
Okay, now I'm curious about the iPad. What app do you use to?
It is Sketchbook.
Okay. Actually,
Just
what
paint.
app does your daughter use to translate it?
Yeah, no, sorry. No, actually, I did do a lot of the drawings, but she had to teach me how to use it. But yeah, we use Sketchbook just for the, so you can take a photograph of your pencil drawing and then draw over the lines using Sketchbook. And she's got an iPad pen, which she's pretty nifty with. And yeah, there's lots of times when I haven't got a clue what I'm doing, so she's taught me layers, because that's another thing. Once I've drawn the template on Sketchbook, then I'll go over and draw the stitch direction lines in blue on a different layer, and then the shading guidelines in red on another layer. And then she's sort of teaching me how to merge all the different layers and technical stuff like that I really don't get.
Yay for kids. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So.
The other part of that, and Beth was commenting on this before we even started talking to you about how in the book you actually lay out your entire process. I mean, anyone can really follow how you get from photo to stitched or stitchable a template, and that's very, very helpful.
No, that's good. I wanted to sort of break it down so that everyone could have the tools to create their own designs. So, as I say, I look at your stitch direction and the shading, where the different colors will change, and also look at light direction. So, imagining where your light source is coming from, so you know where those highlights are going to be. And again, my daughter helped me draw all the diagrams to explain the stitch direction. I mean, sometimes if I'm doing a piece for myself, I kind of do those steps as I'm going along. I'll add the stitch direction actually straight onto the fabric as I'm going along. But if you're starting from scratch, it's re a really useful thing to set up those steps right at the beginning, so you're going into it with a full understanding of what you're trying to achieve.
If you've never done it before, your book gives a great explanation of that too. I think that's what I was
Oh,
very
good.
impressed with.
Oh, good. I'm pleased. It's really difficult to sit down and think to yourself, okay, if I was someone who's never done this before, what do I need to know? What do I take for granted because I've been doing it for so long that other people wouldn't know where to start with?
Especially the light direction, I found that little section. As a non-artist, as a person who doesn't do drawing or that sort of art, to be able to see how you figured that out, that was just, I found that very helpful,
Oh,
little
that's good.
section.
I'm pleased that section's all sort of clear and makes sense.
I mean, there's a lot of strong things about this book, but we mentioned Trish Burr, and one of the strengths of all of her books is that when you buy them, there is plenty of and more than enough instruction for you to learn the basics so that you can execute the designs. And you've done that same thing. The book is all encompassing in that here are some designs that fit with the title and theme of the book that you can stitch, and templates are there. But also, you give more than enough instruction for someone to learn how to actually do the stitching. And so it's not like you have to buy this book and then another book about how to do it. It's all one package. And I, applaud that, because people don't want to build a library. They see that book, they want to design some of those things, and so you make it possible from stem to stern.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. No, I'm glad that it all sits nicely and it's clear and easy to understand. I added the extra little bits in there so that people could just practice as well. So I've tried to teach people how to create the stitches in the first place, but then giving them small practice pieces like one leaf and one berry, and don't try and jump straight into it if you don't want to. You know, practice on those and it'll help. It'll help with the future designs.
Yeah, the one I got stopped on it was a beetle, half of a beetle or something, but just the way you described how to get the stitch lines and the shading and just how to work that all the way to a highlight was very instructive. Really well done. Yeah.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. Thank you so much.
Yeah. I even felt like I could do it.
Well, I'm hoping that if people have bought the book, if they try it, they'll share some of their photos of their work on Instagram and tag me in it so that I can see, because I'd love to see people having a go.
Oh yeah. And then you put at the back of the book, you broke away from the pollinators and put in some of your other designs, and it was such a little bonus in there. I really enjoyed that. And that snail, the snail, I'm telling you, of all the stuff and getting ready for this, you know, looked at everything you did. But that snail, that one just keeps jumping out at me. You really nailed that one. Yeah.
Oh, it was such a cute snail.
Yes.
I took a photograph of it. It was sort of a sunny autumn morning and everything was slightly damp. And it was just so cute. But yeah, I thought I'd add the gallery at the back just to say, you know, if you've learned the basic technique, then, you know, you can go on and try any design you want. Try, this is where you could try and take it or create your own style.
And I liked that. I liked it that, you know, you give everybody the basics and you give them enough. It's not just here's my patterns, here's how to do this stitch, but you teach them how to take an insect maybe we've seen in our garden and say, okay, I now I feel confident I can take something that's local to me and maybe do stitch it up. I just that's a fabulous idea. Love these.
Oh, thank you. No, well, I'm hoping it inspires people to, yeah, as I say, take a closer look at the insects and have a go, because, you know, it does build a respect for them and a love for them. And I'd love to see people out there stitching, creating their own designs and stitching them tagging me, as I say, so I can see what people come up with.
When the book shows up, I mean, obviously multiple opportunities to proofread and check the book as you go through the process, but the feeling of excitement and relief, I guess, when the book shows up, the finished piece.
Oh gosh, yes. When I remember, I sent all of. I mean, I was working on this throughout lockdown. My kids were at home. I was homeschooling, and I was sitting there stitching at the same time. And then I sent it all off to the Search Press last November, and my editor Becky, she put it into just a very basic book format within a few days. So it hadn't been polished and it needed a lot more put in, but she sent it to me and I nearly cried because I just couldn't imagine up until that point of seeing it as a book.
Yeah.
And then when the first, because they sent me a hard copy of the book before the full stock had come into the country, and it turned up in the post, and oh, the thrill of opening your first book and having it there in front of you. And I flicked through it and thought, did I really do all of this? It's a great feeling. It really is.
Yeah. Well, it's a tremendous accomplishment, no doubt about it. Because books take there you have it, a year since you sent it in, essentially a year. And, those take a long time to put together. Yep.
Yeah, well, and lockdown caused all sorts of problems as well, because, well, I mean, normally I would have gone to the publishers for a photo shoot, so they would have done close-ups of my hands and all of the equipment, but we had to work around that because we were in quite a heavy lockdown. So most of the photographs in the book I took all of the step-by-step photographs, and even the photographs of how to thread a needle and how to tie a knot, I sort of posed my fingers whilst my daughter sat on the chair behind me and took the photographs. So, you know, it's amazing that you know, that it looks pretty good, actually. I'm quite pleased. But I sent all of the finished embroideries to Search Press and they took the photographs of those. But yeah, lockdown caused quite a few complications.
Oh, I can imagine. Yeah. So, okay, why aren't we talking to your daughter? she's an integral part of this. That's fantastic that you're able to work with her and have an opportunity like that. Wow.
Well, I think she's indoors playing computer games at the moment.
Oh, okay.
Or she might be drawing. I don't know. She does a lot of drawing.
the art continues in the family. There we go.
It does, yeah. Both of my girls, yeah.
Are you thinking about another book now?
I haven't thought of another book yet. I think we'll see how this one goes, and you know, if Search Press want to have me back, then you know that would be lovely. But I sort of want to see where this book takes me now. I'd like to have a think about, as I say, maybe some teaching in the area. Maybe have a think about, could I put kits together? Because a lot of the kits out there, most of the kits out there use cotton thread, and that's great. And I do recommend to people starting out trying with cotton thread. But I get so many inquiries about what floss do I use, and questions about how you work with fine floss silk thread. So I'm just wondering whether, you know, it'd be interesting to try and put a kit together that uses floss silk rather than the normal cotton. But that's an idea that I've got. But other than that, I don't know. We'll see where it takes me.
Yeah, I think at some point there has to be a mental break after a book. Kind of a regroup type thing.
Yeah, and getting back to some embroidery where I'm not having to photograph every step. The last couple of weeks I've gone back to, I'm creating a piece for an exhibition next year, and I'm enjoying it. So I loved creating the book, but I'm enjoying the freedom of just getting on with the stitching now and not having to constantly think, how do I explain that? I'm really enjoying being back in the shed and stitching away.
Yep. Okay. So the book, you can pre-order now. It's available in the UK on the 31st through, obviously Amazon and other, please support your local needlework stores for these things. They can get the book. And then you said in the U.S., November 9 is the target date?
I think that's right, yes. Yeah. I tried to have a quick look on Amazon earlier, and I think it said November the 9th, yeah.
So you can pre-order. You can get them. Your local needlework store can get them. They're available everywhere. I mean, you even have it, what you said, on the Target website, right?
Yeah, I think I saw it on the Target website, yeah. And is Barnes & Noble one that you have?
Yep, mm-hmm.
Yep, I think it was on their website as well. So it should be readily available, hopefully.
So the old phrase, wherever books are sold.
Exactly.
Yep. Well, it's a fantastic book. Really, really enjoyed reading through it, and lots of great projects, great designs, and boy, congratulations on the achievement. That's huge. Yep.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited for it to be out there in the world.
Yep. All right. Thanks, Victoria. Now, victoriamathewson.com is her website, and do spend some time there. And then Instagram, it's VK Mathewson, Victor Kathy Mathewson, VK Mathewson on Instagram, and you can follow her and see all the, check out the snail. I'm just telling you, the snail is, yeah, that was the winner. Really great. All right, Victoria, thanks. We really enjoyed the time. Appreciate it.
And thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
And thanks to everyone for listening.